Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the opening talk given at the 9th Annual Asian Culture Week, sponsored yearly by Creighton University's Asian World Center. The speaker will be Elizabeth Larris, professor of political science at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and author of Politics and Society in Contemporary China and Economic Reform in China, 1979 to 2003, The Marketization of Labor and State Enterprises. Her topic will be social and economic problems facing China's fifth generation of leaders. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, September 9th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Maorang Zhang, the director of the Asian World Center at Creighton University.
Elizabeth Larris is professor of political science at the University of Mary Washington. Prior to joining the college faculty in 1997, Dr. Larris worked on Capitol Hill as a press secretary and then lived in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. She has taught courses on American, European, and Asian governments at Lingnan University in Hong Kong, the University of Virginia, and the University of Richmond. She is author of the books Politics and Society in Contemporary China and Economic Reform in China, 1979 to 2003, The Marketization of Labor and State Enterprises, as well as more than 20 book chapters and scholarly articles. In 2012-2013, Professor Larris presented papers at academic conferences in the United States, Taiwan, and Great Britain. Please join me in welcome Dr. Larris for her presentation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. First, I'd like to thank Creighton University for inviting me out here. As Professor Zhang said, I graduated from Creighton just a few years ago. And so it's always delightful to come back. The campus looks beautiful, and I'm glad to see such interest in Asian studies at Creighton. This is, you know, Asia's hot, right? It is hot. And so get in on the ground floor, because this is really where the future is. All right, so today you can see I'm talking about challenges of economic and social development faced by China's fifth generation of leaders. And if you're not familiar with the term fifth generation, I'll go through that in a second. All right, face of middle class China. Okay, this is a young lady who actually recently left China. Her name is Chen Guo, and she had a pretty good thing going on in China. She had a good job, she had an apartment, but she was concerned about her future, about the security of living in China down the road. She was looking at the economic situation, some growing economic uncertainty in China, and also social discontent. She's also looking toward her retirement, taking care of family, and I just really found that it was better to leave China and to come to the United States rather than to stay in China because of all the problems we're going to talk about in a little while. That said, every year, actually, China loses more people emigrate out of China than are moving into China. Migration into China is actually very limited by the government, so that's one reason. But a lot of Chinese are living because they're finding that not only are their fortunes elsewhere, young Chinese can make good money in China now, but it's lifestyle. It's all those other things that you look at when you're considering your future, not just earning money. And so she, like many of her contemporaries, has left China. So let's look at those reasons why. Okay. Let's look at the basis of legitimacy for China's leaders right now. And that's going to tie into why so many people are leaving, that unless this generation of leadership can really firmly establish and maintain its legitimacy, people are going to lose confidence in the regime. Okay, so very basically, you know, going back to what Political Science 101, we can look at the various sources of legitimacy for regime leaders. And those ways that leaders establish their legitimacy can be by results, okay? Very often revolution, right? Revolutionary leaders then have so-called legitimacy. That is the belief on the part of the people that those in power have the right and the authority to carry out decisions, and that those decisions should be obeyed. Okay, that's basically legitimacy. So very often revolutionaries have legitimacy because they brought about revolution in the minds of people, positive revolution, right? And so we could think of revolutionaries, we could think of George Washington, Mao Zedong having legitimacy by results. Of course, when Hitler rose to power, right, revitalized post-World War I Germany, he had legitimacy because of results, right? Got industry a year after he came to power up to pre-war levels. Those are pretty good results. All right. Legitimacy by habit. A lot of monarchies have legitimacy by habit. People have gotten used to it. This is just the way it is. This is the way it'll always be. And that doesn't take too much explanation. Historical, religious, or ethnic identity. You look at many political parties around the world, and they have legitimacy because they represent a particular ethnic group, or again, they have historical ties. Look at the Middle Eastern monarchs. The Middle Eastern monarchs are surviving now when dictators are falling, right? Because they have that ethnic identity, also because of historical reasons, so they're able to hang on. And then procedures would be elections, okay? We tend to think that our government, people we elect to government, are legit because we have chosen them, or at least a majority, a plurality of people have chosen them. So let's look at sources of legitimacy then for Chinese leaders, okay? The earlier generations of Chinese leaders, of course, China's now into its fifth generation of leaders, for the most part, had legitimacy by results and or historical identity. Of course, the first generation was made up of Mao Zedong and the contemporaries, Zhou Enlai, Chen Duxiu, Peng Dehuai, a lot of the guys that brought about the revolution. They participated in the Long March. They survived the Long March of 1934 and 1935 when the nationalists, the anti-communists, were chasing them all over China. Clearly, they had the right stuff, right? They become revolutionaries. They overthrow the nationalist regime, which was backed by the United States. So they pull off a victory, not just against, you know, the nationalists, the anti-communists, but a world power, because we were backing the nationalists. Those are pretty, you know, darn good results to the Chinese people, right? And so in 1949, you've got Mao Zedong declaring China for the Chinese. Okay, so the Communist Party, and then the earlier generations, of course, who were communists, had that legitimacy by results. Okay. Now, certainly, Mao is credited with raising about 100 million people out of poverty. Despite the tremendous roller coaster that he took the Chinese people on, he did raise people out of poverty, and that was significant. Okay, so those are also results that the first generation could have as a claim to fame and as a basis of their legitimacy. The second generation really begins with Deng Xiaoping and his sidekick, Hu Yaobang, and I don't know, you know, some of the names that you may have studied before. Of course, historical identity, they were long marchers as well. They belonged to the Communist Party, the Revolutionary Party, again, that established China for the Chinese, but then also Deng Xiaoping's results, and that is jettisoning socialism and reviving the Chinese economy. And by the time Deng Xiaoping passes away in 1997, World Bank at least credits him and his regime, that second generation, with raising 500 million people out of poverty. What's the population of the United States? Around 300 million. So we're talking about 1.5 times the U.S. population being risen out of poverty in China in really those 2 decades, around those 20 years, when Deng Xiaoping and his cohort were in power. Okay. And of course, Deng Xiaoping introduces China to the world stage, right? He comes to power, we'll say 1979, gradually implements his reforms in 1980, the early 80s. He's pushing against tremendous headwinds, but finally in 1992 and thereafter is able to really implement his reforms. And so China, you know, when I was first looking at China way back when, it didn't have any standing in the on the world stage. It was not an emerging economy at the time in the early 1980s. If you looked at the top 10 emerging economies in the world, China was not one of them. And of course, one of Deng Xiaoping's goals was to have China emerge onto the world economy and then not only emerge but become a significant player in the world economy. And he really very much achieved that by his death in 1997. So he passes away, and then he is succeeded by the third generation, Zhao Ziyang, and a litany of other people. And again, they're still, their identity is the Communist Party, and the Communist Party has that historical identity. So they're riding on that. But also, their results are great guns. Gung-ho economic development at all costs. Okay, and if the cost we're going to see is development of the Chinese mainland, but you'll see most, of course, of the development was in coastal China, particularly southern coastal China. Okay, and so, but that was a plan. Deng Xiaoping said, we are going to allow the southern coastal area to move ahead quickly and first. Then we will develop the interior, because the interior is vast, it's slower, that's a long-term project. Okay. And so the third generation just goes great guns in developing the economy, but there's not still a lot done for the interior. The fourth generation, historical identity and somewhat results. The problem, though, with the fourth generation is by the time the fourth generation comes around, there is increasing disparity, economic and social disparity in China. And so the fourth generation's task was supposed to distribute the wealth. And no, I take that back. Really, to bump up and distribute economic growth and development throughout the rest of China. And in fact, the fourth generation did have, well, they had their marching orders from Deng Xiaoping. Again, Deng Xiaoping comes to power in 79, passes away in 97. But he has a plan for China's economic growth and development for decades. And he essentially passes down to the third and fourth generation their marching orders. Third generation, keep going with economic reform, growth and development. Fourth generation, spread it out. Okay, make sure that you take care of the interior. But because the interior is so vast and because of entrenched interests on the coasts, you know, the parties that are getting a lot of the investment from the banks, from the central government in Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, Hangzhou, all those eastern cities, they don't want to share it all with the interior. So even though the fourth generation had this plan, and it's you'll see it translated to English different ways, but it's like the Great Western Development Plan to develop the West. Another term for it is develop the West. And the West is really around two-thirds of China's country. That really never takes off adequately. And so the fourth generation really wasn't able to carry out the marching orders that Deng Xiaoping had left to them. Okay, so now it's up to the fifth generation, right, to make this all work. Okay, so here we go. And of course, Xi Jinping came in as General Secretary of the Communist Party last year and then also President of State. He has a big head, okay, so he wears three hats, right? He is President of State, he is General Secretary of the Communist Party, so he's at the apex of power in the Communist Party. And then, of course, he's also the head of the military. He chairs the Central Military, Military Commission, which is a party entity that controls the military. Okay, so he's a very busy man. All right, so here we have the fifth generation, Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang. All right, what will be the basis of legitimacy of China's fifth generation? Of course, still results, right? But what type of results? Now we're talking about the need for stability and quality of life issues, okay? Hundreds of millions of people have been raised out of poverty. Yeah, there's still quite a bit of poverty in certain areas, in rural areas, in the interior, But the previous generations have been doing a pretty good job of economic growth and development. But there are other life issues, right? People have more money. They're not starving the way, of course, you know, centuries ago they did. But there's more to life than just making the money. They got to look at, okay, taking care of the elderly. They've got tremendous environmental problems. If you've been to China, you're aware of the environmental problems there. And a whole host of problems that we'll get to in a minute. So it's really on the basis of dealing with these problems I'm going to go through that they will establish their legitimacy if they're going to have it. So let's start with demographics. Wow. When I was your age, if anyone had, had told me that China would have, you know, a labor shortage, it would have been laughable, right? And they do. Actually, just this year, the chickens have come home to roost. China is now facing a labor shortage. China has a population of 1.3 billion people, right? Largest population, most populated country in the world. India comes second with a billion, and then down from there. Okay. And so yeah, someone asked me right before the lecture, what, there's not enough people, 1.3 billion, is not enough people to work? Look at the generations, though. Look what's happening in China. As you may or may not have studied, very soon after Deng Xiaoping came to power, the Chinese communists implemented this one-child policy. And that is Han Chinese, which is 92% of the population, in urban areas were restricted to one child, okay? In rural areas, they could have more than one. They could have two if they were farmers. And then in the countryside especially, if the firstborn was a girl, because in the interior, most people were still farmers, then they could have a second child hoping for a boy. And then China's ethnic minorities theoretically did not have a limit on children. They were encouraged to only have two at the most. But many local cadres, overzealous local cadres, really enforced a one-child policy throughout much of China, even though there were these exempted groups. But again, most people in China, 92% of the population is Han, and particularly amongst the urban Chinese, they could only have one child. Okay. And so 1979, you younger people, you were born after 79, right? So we're talking now one, two generations now of just one-child families. So look at 1953, okay? Mao Zedong and the communists established the People's Republic of China in late 1949, right? And so really just three, 4 years after that communist victory, let's look at the demographics, okay? More than 36% of China's population was under the age of 14, and only 4% were over the age of 65. Okay, I don't know, what does that mean to us? Let's compare with today, okay? You have more than 23% under the age of 14. So compare, right? There's been a bit of drop from 36 to 23, and then 9% over 65. Okay, so just look at the trend, the trajectory of those numbers. You have an aging population, okay? And so when we're talking about labor, and when I talk in a few minutes more about healthcare and who's taking care of all the elderly, that's a whole nother issue, right? Okay, so talking about labor, What has been happening is, yes, you know, people, these babies, right, they grow up and they look for jobs. And because of the failure to develop the West, of course, a lot of them migrated to cities, particularly to manufacturing entities in southern coastal China, owned by Chinese, by overseas Chinese, you know, Hong Kong Chinese, Taiwan Chinese, and Americans. And they worked in factories. And then a lot of them grew up and had their own kids. Okay, but as they became skilled, they come in unskilled. And over the years, as they become skilled, they put pressure on for higher wages, right? I'll give you an example. I don't have it portrayed here, but you may have heard of this, the Foxconn situation. Foxconn is actually a Taiwan-owned company that produces the iPhone for Apple in China. And it has thousands of employees, a lot of them rural Chinese who moved to southern coastal China to work in Foxconn. They're looking for jobs. Okay. They're living in dorms. It's very crowded, very low wages, low. A number of them, in a very disturbing pattern, committed suicide. And they were just saying, we can't take the pressure to produce. There's such tremendous pressure. We're so low paid. We're worried about our families back home. We're working very long hours. We're not getting overtime. And so there was a raft of suicides. Now, because it was a foreign-owned firm, you know, a Taiwan firm, making really an American product, the spotlight then was on Foxconn. And so the Chinese government then had to say, look, you got to do something here. You got to raise these people's wages. You got to cut back on the hours that they're working. Okay. And so replicate that situation where people start demanding higher wages. If you don't give me a higher wage, I'm going to go work for another company. And so wages now have gone up across China, and it's becoming more expensive to produce there. So you will not see a flood of American and foreign firms leaving China. What you will see is maybe they will move 10, 20, 30, 40% of their production elsewhere. Okay, they might move it back to the United States. Because compounded with the change in demographics and the rising wages, there's still a significant amount of corruption, red tape. You need to have the right connections to do business. And for Westerners, that is Americans, it's more difficult than the overseas Chinese to especially because, you know, Americans are bound by the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Okay, so there's a lot of things that American firms just cannot do in China that other people can do. And so compounded by the rising costs, some companies are moving a certain amount of production back to the United States. And if they don't move back to the United States, then they will look for the next low-wage place, which right now is Vietnam, Malaysia. Increasingly, it'll be Burma, still the Philippines. Okay, and so it doesn't necessarily mean that American manufacturing is going to come back to America. It can't, because other countries, everyone is in China, and increasingly Philippines, Burma, Vietnam. Okay, the Swedes, the French, the Japanese, the Germans, everyone is there. That's who we're competing with, right? We can't just bring all the manufacturing back to the United States. Okay, but what happens is when these companies take a certain amount of production out of China and send it off elsewhere or bring it back home, then there's fewer jobs, right? And so then the Chinese government gets nervous because it doesn't want oodles of people unemployed, right? It'll have to send them back to the countryside. People don't want to go back to the countryside, and so you've got a real, real problem there. Okay. Little fun fact here I've written down. By the year 2050, now I don't know where I'm going to be in 2050, but anyway, by the year 20, it's going to come around before we know it, right? By the year 2050, one-third of China's population, one-third of China's population will be over 60 years old. Wow. Think about that for a second, right? Who's going to be supporting all those old people, and who's going to be working, right? So what's the solution? Certainly one approach is for China to transition away from what's called labor-intensive industry, right? Making the cheap plastic toys, the apparel. Labor-intensive industries are those industries where, well, you just need a lot of cheap labor. And China, in the last, in previous decades, had a nearly inexhaustible supply of cheap labor. That was its comparative advantage. Okay. As labor gets more expensive, then China will have to, it won't do this to the entire economy, but part of the economy then will start to get into capital-intensive industry, much the way Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, you know, the Asian tigers did, that they start producing goods that take more capital startup costs, electronics, higher-end electronics, right? Not just the DVD players now, which are just mostly simple assembly, but when they get into the higher end manufacturing, okay, then you can you'll certainly pay people higher wages, and which will also boost consumption. So you will, in all likelihood, see what's called economic structural reform in China, a movement, at least part of the economy, away from labor intensive industry to capital intensive industry, and that will make a lot of sense for China. Okay, all right, Social Security. Ooh, we got alphabet soup here. All right, IRB and OBP, IRB. Iron rice bowl, one big pot. I don't know if you remember reading that, but that's old. That's old stuff. Okay. When Mao and the communists came to power, what they took was basically a capitalist system, and they imposed socialism on it. They nationalized nearly all industry in industry and businesses in China so that everyone was working for a state firm, okay? And as a part of that, they got what was called an iron rice bowl. Now, when we go out for Chinese food, do they ever serve your bowl of rice in an iron rice bowl? Nah. What is it served in? What's it served in? Other than a takeout box, right? Porcelain, right. And you drop porcelain on the floor, what happens? It breaks, right? Drop an iron rice bowl on the on the floor, what happens? Better watch your toe, right? Yeah, it'll stay intact. So the iron rice bowl was, it was a whole set of benefits. It was really, a guarantee of lifelong job tenure and associated benefits, housing, health care, education for the kids, and retirement pensions that employees did not have to contribute to, okay? They just got this as part of the iron rice bowl. And it was called iron because it couldn't break, okay? Couldn't break. And then the one big pot meant egalitarian wages. That didn't mean that everyone in China was making the same amount of money. What it meant was that if you had a certain seniority in a company and a certain task and a certain level, then you would all get paid the same amount regardless of effort. And so let's say if I were a very hard worker and someone else were lazy, we would get paid the same amount if we had the same seniority, the same task. Okay, so there was no incentive to work really hard, okay? You went to work, you got your housing, you got your benefits, your pension taken care of, and you got paid regardless of effort, okay? Deng Xiaoping comes along and he says, well, you know what? 50% of these state firms are losing money. We just can't keep bailing out all these state firms. We have to break the iron rice bowl, and we have to get rid of that one big pot. And that was very, very difficult. In actuality, it took almost 20 years to dismantle that system because of the resistance that he ran into on the part of the old socialists. Okay. But the problem is when China got rid of the iron rice bowl and the one big pot, they privatized or they corporatized businesses. That is, businesses now... are shareholding corporations, right? You can buy shares of stock into Chinese businesses. The state may or may not be the largest shareholder. Okay. When they essentially broke up these businesses, they privatized, they corporatized these state businesses, the Chinese central government did not implement a national comprehensive social security system or healthcare system. Okay, we're familiar with Social Security, right, in this country. FDR started it during the Depression because he was looking around and he literally saw a starving elderly. And he says, no, this will not do. And so, of course, Social Security was never supposed to be a retirement pension, but it's the idea that the elderly get enough to live on so they're not starving in the United States, okay? And in the United States, it's an entitlement, right? You hit 65, regardless of your level of income, you are entitled to Social Security, okay? China does not have that system. So here people were losing their benefits, their pensions, but it wasn't being replaced by a comprehensive national Social Security system, okay? And so to this day, and again, Deng Xiaoping started dismantling the iron rice bowl in one big pot really back in the late 80s, accelerated in the 90s, and accelerated after that. And so in all this time, China still does not have a comprehensive Social Security system. They do have it. It's a patchwork type system, which is very complicated. And the Social Security that does exist is largely funded by local governments, okay, that are being overburdened with this. Okay, and so less than 55% of adults in China today are covered by Social Security. So who's going to take care of them, right, in their old age? Now, what happened is a lot of these people, they did not have to put away money for their pensions. Now workers do. And so they're making sure they're putting away money for their survival after retirement. Okay. And that creates a certain amount of insecurity because they're going to have to put really a lot of money away, okay, to live on. Okay. Pensions that they might still get from a company are very small and really not enough to live on in retirement. China has tried to implement, again, a patchwork rather than a universal Social Security system. And what they do is they say, okay, employees and employers need to put money away for an employee, and then the state also puts in a little bit into the pot, okay? Out of that pot, only a very small portion has the employee's name on it. The rest is held for other people who are retiring, much like the U.S. Social Security system, right? If you're working now, right, whatever money you're paying into Social Security isn't going to you, right? It's going to people who are retired now. Well, what's happening in China is because they're pooling these funds and only a small portion has the employee's name on it, you've got a pool of money there. What do governments do when they've got a pool of money sitting around? They start tapping into it for all kinds of other things. And then you have corrupt local officials that they build their careers on economic development, right? And so they want to build a bridge. They want to build a factory. Where are they getting their money from? They're tapping into these pools of Social Security. So that's a problem when, you know, as I said, by what was the statistic? By the year 2050, one-third of the population is going to be over 60 years old. What's going to happen if these local governments keep tapping into these pools? And now they have to pay, you know, pensions, albeit limited pensions, to those huge numbers of elderly. That's going to be a big problem down the road. Okay. And so, again, the pension pool pays for today's retirees or local government needs. That's the rub, right? Okay. You know, on this note, and this is a theme I'm going to actually keep coming back to, is because of these issues, the aging population, Social Security, lack of health care, typical Chinese save like crazy, okay? Generally, 25% of household income goes into savings because people are saving for health care, retirement, and for education for the kids, the three bigs, they're called. As you probably know, much of China's economic growth and development in the last 30 years has relied very heavily on export earnings, right? I mean, again, you're China, you go to the store, go to Walmart, used to be made in America stuff, right? Now it's all like made in China stuff, right? Everywhere you go, everything's made in China. China is exporting like crazy because, number one, all those manufacturing industries employed people who left state employment when the Iron Rice Bowl and the One Big Pot were broken up, right? So they need those manufacturing entities for employment, and also, of course, it brings in revenue to the country. All right. But the problem is when you have an economic recession in the United States or a global slowdown, like, you know, it came out of the financial crisis in 2008, people buy fewer Chinese goods. Chinese exports slow down. What happens to the Chinese economy? The Chinese economy slows down. Everyone's all excited, right? For 30 years, China's economy has grown, on average, by double digits, around 10%. Okay? The last year or two, they've slowed down to 8, 7%. Everyone's all excited. Oh, China's going to collapse. I don't think so, right? We would love to have that kind of growth in this country. But still, if we are buying fewer Chinese goods, then less money flowing into China, economy slows down. So again, they have to restructure their economy. They want to rely less on exports, more on consumption, okay? If you look at American GDP, right, the components of economic growth in the United States, part of it is consumption, part of it's export earnings, part of it is government spending. Of those three, consumption, we're surprised by that, right? Consumption is the highest. Don't quote me on this, but I think that consumption is around 60 to 70% of American GDP. Okay, again, don't quote me. But in China, it's very small, 20, maybe 30%. Okay, they're still very reliant on export earnings. And so the fifth generation is looking and saying, we cannot be so reliant on exports because our economy is vulnerable when things slow down. We need people to spend more. Well, you're Chinese, how are you going to spend more? You lost your Iron Rice Bowl and your One Big Pot, right? No, you're saving for retirement, for your kids' education, which used to be free, right? Now you're spending and retirement and health care, okay? And so a lot of Chinese save, so they're not consuming to the level that the government wants them to. And the government keeps saying, we want you to consume more, but until they restructure things, they're not going to boost consumption to the level that they want. Okay. So, yeah, I keep referring to healthcare. Let's go there now. All right. Okay, under the Iron Rice Bowl and One Big Pot systems, the old states, the cellular economy that Mao created, again, people received rudimentary basic health care, but it was pretty much universal. And, of course, you'd be better off in urban areas than in rural areas. The government, the central government, mandated that there would be healthcare clinics in the countryside. And again, very rudimentary. A rather derisive term for these practitioners out in the countryside was barefoot doctors, people that had just very basic training, okay, that, you know, would give you a shot, take a temperature, you know, that kind of thing. After really the collapse of the socialist system, or the jettison of the socialist system and the move toward capitalism, a lot of the doctors left the countryside because it just didn't pay. They went to the cities and made money. And so out in the countryside was, and in some areas to this day, is very difficult to get any kind of health care. Hospital, you have to really travel to a hospital, and then you have to pay up front. And the peasants can't afford it, so they end up going untreated until it's catastrophic, and then the family has to go into debt to pay the doctor at, you know, the urban hospital that might be three or four hours away. Okay, and so for about a decade and a half of that, the Chinese government's looking and says, "This is, we got a disaster on our hands here because we do not have adequate resources, health care coverage, insurance for these people." Okay, and so they did start various programs, but they're rather spotty. Okay, notice the central government spends actually relatively little of its national income on health care, less than 1% of GDP, among the lowest in the world. Now, you know, the Chinese government says we still are a poor country. Per capita income average per capita income in China is, I'm rounding up, $5,000. Actually, World Bank says it's $4,000-something. Okay, so $5,000. But that's the average, because China has millionaires and billionaires now. Okay, there are still 200 million Chinese living in China that live on less than a dollar a day. Again, the U.S. population is, what, 300 million? So think about 200 million living on less than a dollar a day. Okay. And again, per capita income, about $5,000. And so that's the middle to low tier of developing country. And so the government says, we're a relatively poor country. We can't spend, you know, and we have a huge population, by the way, right? And so, but even amongst poor countries, China's central government spends relatively little on health care. Okay. And so what happens is people have to pay out of pocket very often. And again, very often they're waiting for that catastrophic illness like a cancer, aneurysm, tumor, things like that. All right. Notice households save 25% of income for a calamity. That's, I mean, do you save 25% of your income? You know, what Americans before 2008 was negative, right? We were in debt. I think savings was like negative 2%, right? So that's really, that's incredible. Okay. And up until recently, this figure is starting to change, but until recently, more than 7% of rural household expenditures was just spent on health alone, okay? Because, again, rural areas are very poor, and so proportionate to their income, they're spending a lot on health. Okay. And so the Chinese central government then came up with various plans for different constituencies in the population and for different areas. The first one we'll talk about is the urban employee medical insurance system. That's a mouthful. Okay. Pretty self-descriptive, right? Again, this is insurance. Now, insurance means that people have to buy into it. Okay. Some of it's subsidized by the central government or the local government. Depends on where people live. Okay. But it's also something that people have to buy. Remember, under the old Maoist system, they didn't have to pay for their insurance. Okay, so now people are paying for their insurance, but it only covers about 17% of medical costs. A lot of exemptions, okay, a lot of things that it doesn't cover. Okay, so that's for the urban employed. All right, but in Chinese cities, there are a lot of unemployed or people working in the informal sector, which they're migrants, okay? They're migrants from other areas of China, and they might be working like off the books, Okay, the informal sector is that sector that is not taxed, okay, that the government is not collecting tax on them. Also, not mentioned here, something that complicates the migrants' situation in getting benefits is China still has a residency card system. It's not as important as it used to be, but they still have it. It's called a hukou. I don't know if you've heard of that term before. But everyone who is born gets a residency card that states their birthplace and their family's occupation. And it used to be in the old Maoist day that, let's say, if you had a farming hukou in rural Anhui province, you could not just move to a city and get a job. Because, number one, there would be no place to live. No one would hire you in a state firm because you didn't have that, let's say you were going to, what did I say, Hangzhou or Shanghai? You didn't have the Shanghai hukou. You had an Anhui farmer's hukou, okay? China still uses that residency card system. The reason that the Maoists did it, and they borrowed actually a program from an earlier imperial system, is as they were developing the urban areas, they did not want this mad influx of hundreds of millions of Chinese to urban areas because they would then overstress the urban areas. And so it was a way to segment the population, urban China versus rural China. Okay. But now with foreign businesses in China, a foreign business doesn't care that, oh, you don't have the right hukou. Just come, work for me, I'll pay you, sleep in the dorm, I'll give you, you know, some food every day. Okay. But for services, you really need to have the proper hukou for education, for health care. Okay. So China has, and I'm rounding here, around 200 million migrants. 200 million. They're called the floating population. They come from the countryside. They may be seasonal labor. They go and work in the cities for a while. Then at harvest time or planting, they go back home and they help the family. Then they go work in the city again. And it could be a close city or it could be a 37-hour train ride to coastal China. So they ebb, they flow. So if you go to China and you look at the trains, public transportation, they're just mobbed. You know, the train stations are mobbed with these migrants. 200 million people, right, floating around the country. It's huge. Well, again, most of them don't have the requisite hukou. Okay. So there is this unemployed, the urban resident basic medical service for the unemployed. But notice it's a subsidized voluntary public health insurance. It's voluntary. So people don't have to pay them. They don't have to buy it. So if a migrant gets sick, more than often he or she will not go to hospital. There are these so-called black clinics in, like, you know, back alleys in Beijing, Shanghai, other urban areas where the migrants will go to. And they're really substandard, very, very substandard. Okay. All right, and then for the people out in the countryside, wow, they really got, you know, a bum deal when all the doctors left and went to the urban areas. The Chinese government implemented the new cooperative medical scheme for rural areas. But notice it's for treatment of serious disease. So people who have an ailment or may not know what they have is serious, they're foregoing care. And then finally, when it reaches the later stages and they realize, ooh, this is serious, then they need to go to the hospital and be seen. And then very often it's too late or it's much worse, you know, than it could have been if it had been treated earlier. So there are these programs. A few years ago, the Chinese government accelerated the numbers of people, bringing people into these. Now most people belong to one of these and have some type of insurance. But again, they're paying for it. So it's money out of their pockets, and it doesn't cover everything. It's not universal. It's not single payer like UK, Canada, or Germany. And again, it limits how much people can save because they're really concerned about some type of calamity. Okay. There's also the problem of corruption in China's healthcare. There is corruption, you know, in healthcare, medical services, you know, in other places, of course, other than China. It's just more egregious in China because of the way the system is set up. It's not very transparent. Government, politics, transactions in China are not transparent than the way in the United States. And so there's a lot of room for corruption. What has happened now is, particularly in the urban hospitals, one way for the hospitals to make money is for the doctors to prescribe serious procedures when something more simple can be done. They prescribe excess amount of drugs because they get money selling the drugs, and then they order up a lot of tests because the more tests they order, the more money they make. Okay, and so it's also, if you go to, not if you're a foreigner, but if you're Chinese and you have to go to the hospital in an urban area, there were so many people that were going to the hospital, getting treatment, and leaving and not paying, that you have to pay up front for your care. And generally, it's quite a lot of money, and then you get like a rebate, or you get some money back if you didn't use it all when you or your relative leaves. Okay. Also, the doctors, of course, are relatively busy. So how do you bump up to the front of the line? You give them the hongbao. And hongbao were these red envelopes. You might be familiar around Chinese New Year. Adults will put, a little bit of money or something in them for, kids at Chinese New Year. But the term hongbao now really means a bribe, okay? And so for someone in your family to get medical care, timely medical care, a lot of people have to pass the hongbao. And that is an increasing problem in China. And of course, I mean, who can't pay, right? The rural poor, the urban poor, and so you're what China is ending up with is a bifurcated healthcare system where the people who can pay get decent care, and the hospitals in the major cities are wonderful, they're beautiful, nice technology, very 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 good care, but for again people who can't afford or can't afford the hongbao, the treatment is not as good. Well, okay, do I need to talk about environmental concerns? Check that out. My goodness. I distinctly remember having a conversation with a friend not too long ago. He had gone to Beijing, and he was on the airplane, and he told me that he couldn't even see the end of the runway because of the pollution. I remember going to Beijing one time and looking out my hotel window, and it was just overcast. And I thought, oh, it's going to rain today. Better take the umbrella. And it never rained. The second day, it looks like it's going to rain. Take the umbrella. Third day, take the umbrella. Finally, by the fourth day, I realized it's not going to rain. That's just the air. It just looks like that, and it has gotten worse, actually, since that time that I'm telling you about. Actually, a lot of foreign companies now are finding difficulty in filling positions in Beijing, which is pretty far north, Xi'an, which is north and west, Shenyang, northern areas. Particularly the closer you get to the Gobi Desert, Inner Mongolia, they have those tremendous sandstorms. China has sandstorms in the spring, and the most immobilizing sandstorms would happen maybe, once a decade. That now recently it's every 5 years, and more recently it's been every year. Every year. I think it was maybe about 3 years ago, there was such terrible sandstorms in mainland China that the sand, the fine particles, the dust, they blew over to Hong Kong and to Taiwan, which is 100 kilometers off of Fujian province, southern coastal China. They actually had to shut down the airport, Chiang Kai-shek Airport in Taiwan, because of lack of visibility, and that was coming from China. Okay, and particulates actually have been found not just in California, but further in, what's a state in or two? Nevada, trying to think, going a little bit, we'll see. Utah? Yeah, Nevada, okay. Yeah, okay. So, I was just reading an article in Wall Street Journal recently that Chinese airlines are hiring a lot of Western pilots, and they pay a lot of money. And some of the pilots are okay because they're not living in the soup all the time. But if they have to move families and be based in China, a lot of them, are turning it down even though it's high pay because of the respiratory ailments in particular that people are coming home with. Okay. What can I say? China suffers from soil, air, water pollution. And this is largely because of, great guns, economic growth at all costs. Mao began it. It accelerated, of course, in the post-Mao years. When Mao and the Chinese communists socialized or nationalized the Chinese economy, they adopted the Soviet form of growth and development, and that was emphasis on heavy industry. Heavy industry that, steel making and cement making, machine tool factories, and those early manufacturing plants, those factories, were extremely energy inefficient, as a lot of them still are, and just belched out a lot of coal effluent. China's coal, unfortunately for China, is particularly dirty. Okay, American coal, Indonesian coal has lower sulfur content, and so it's not as polluting. But Chinese coal has a very high sulfur content. And so they would use it for industry and also for home heating in the north. And so, and then at the same time, I don't know if, taking a Chinese history course, a political science course, I don't know if you remember the Great Leap Forward, where Mao said, in a decade, Chinese economy is going to leap ahead of the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the United States. This was in the 1950s, and those were the economic powers at the time. And China, which again was dirt poor, was going to leap ahead of these industrial powers. How were you going to do that? You were going to mobilize the masses. And he had people building backyard, they were called backyard furnaces. They were rudimentary steel mills that, we're in class here, and the ding, 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 the bell goes off, and we all have to go out there, what is that plaza called? And we all have to make steel. Okay, for the country, and then also to support North Korea. All right, and so how do you get your fuel source, right, to feed these rudimentary steel mills? You chop down the trees, right? So in the Mao years, China suffered from tremendous deforestation leading to desertification, which leads to the topsoil blowing away, which leads to this type of a problem. And then again, as the Chinese communists embraced rapid economic growth. And again, if you are a party cadre out in a local area, you get promoted according to how much growth and factories you bring to your area, right? Not how nice you are to the people, how you listen to the people, right? And so they turned a lot of China's agricultural land. China's a shortage of agricultural land in the first place, but local cadres turned agricultural land into factory land, turned into factories, highly polluting, okay, to boost their careers. The World Bank estimates that about 750,000 Chinese die prematurely from respiratory diseases. Who's dying? Of course, the very young, the ill, and the elderly. 750,000, okay? That's a heck of a lot. That's a heck of a lot of people that die prematurely. And that's due to air and water pollution. We didn't even get to water. Most of the water in China is polluted. The water in five of China's seven major rivers and tributaries is unsuitable for human contact. Wow. Don't drink the water if you go to China, right? Yeah. Don't drink the water. What do we think the farmers are irrigating with? Polluted water, right? Yeah. And then to boost production, they've used a bunch of arable land to turn into factories, to employ people, to build careers. What's left of the agricultural land has to produce more and more and more and more. How do you do that? Use a lot of fertilizer. And where does that run off to? Right, that runs off into the water. Okay. Then there are fishermen in China, used to make a living along the rivers, right, and the lakes, fishing. Well, what happened to their livelihoods, right? So they're losing their livelihoods, and if they go into the water to fish, to catch fish, take their boats in and out, they're getting skin lesions, all kinds of problems. Okay, and again, who's going to take care of all these sick people, right? They don't have universal health care. People are saving money to pay for health insurance. And you have an aging population, so you're going to have more and more people that are going to need care because of these concerns. Okay. Rural-urban disparity, as you guess, there's an increasing income gap. I don't know if you're familiar with the Gini Index. It measures income disparity. Brazil used to have the highest gap between, rich and poor. China, still nominally a communist country, is approximating the Gini Index for Brazil. And that's not going down very well with a lot of people, right? Okay.
I think I went through some of these stats already. Still a lot of poor people, so they migrate. They migrate to the cities, and they have much difficulty. Again, they're migrating to the cities because of something called urban bias. And this is something that a lot of developing countries do. They put their resources, their investment into urban areas because that's where you have the concentration of the population. And if they're not happy with you, they overthrow you, right? Not in the countryside because people dispersed out there. They're marginalized. It's harder for them to organize and overthrow you. And so because of the development in the cities, then people want to come to the cities. And then they end up, you know, taxing those resources. Also, you know, in the countryside, people are leaving because what do you think happens when the local cadre confiscates land and turns it into a factory? They're losing land. Farmers in China don't have property rights. They do not own the land. They lease it from the government. So when the government official comes and says, oh, it looks like you have some corn coming up there, too bad, we're going to make this into a factory, they really, you know, they go, they protest, they write letters to the government, they might go to Beijing, and then it's generally not resolved. Yeah, yeah. I think I read a statistic somewhere, like in what, you know, 2010, 3 out of 2,000 cases were favorable resolved, you know, for the claimant. Okay, so as you can imagine, there's growing discontent in China. There has been discontent in rural China for decades, particularly over egregious land grabs, the presence of poverty when the Communist Party said, we're going to raise you all up. It's increasingly spreading to cities. And you'll see a lot of demonstrations. You won't see. You don't see it in the Western media so much, right? We don't cover it so much. But increasingly, people in cities are discontent, and they're coming out, and they're protesting, and they're letting the government know that, especially as growth rates decline, inflation has gone up, and then corruption and crony capitalism as the leadership and the princelings, the sons and the daughters of the leadership, are running businesses. They're literally getting away with murder. Out in Chongqing, Bo Xilai was a rising star in the Communist Party. Lo, his financial advisor, ends up dead. His wife is accused of murder for it, and it goes on and on and on. Really wacky story there. Big corruption scandal there. And then we could pretty much finish up here with, as you're probably familiar with, there are periodic and very violent ethnic tensions in Tibet and Xinjiang, the Muslim Northwest, as the government squeezes their rights and says, you know, you can't have a picture of the Dalai Lama in the monasteries. In Xinjiang, the kids cannot learn Arabic in the schools. Then the people, they protest that, they fight against that, and then the government comes in with what is called strike hard campaigns and pummel the people down. And then they're upset by that, further threatening the stability of the country. All right, so there we go. So what's the fifth generation left with? Yeah, some problems, right? And how are they going to deal with them? People in China are increasingly aware of the problems. You know, during Mao's day, there wasn't much awareness because the media was all state-controlled, right? The media in China today is largely private. Now the editors, they self-edit, they're controlled by the Communist Party. But it's interesting, at least 2/3 of the media in China is private. People have access to the internet, even though it's censored. People your age, students your age, they know how to get the information. So people know there's this discontent throughout the country. And increasingly, it is reported on. And so they're looking at Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang and saying, you know, what gives? We need to work on a lot of these problems that we have here. And if we don't, then we're going to have a very unstable future. And I might just end up like, you know, the girl in the beginning of my presentation and leaving, you know, if at all possible. All right. Thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the opening talk given at the 9th Annual Asian Culture Week, sponsored yearly by Creighton University's Asian World Center. The speaker has been Elizabeth Leris, professor of political science at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and author of Politics and Society in Contemporary China and Economic Reform in China, 1979-2003, The Marketization of Labor and State Enterprises. Her topic was Social and Economic Problems Facing China's Fifth Generation of Leaders. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, September 9th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Maorong Jiang, Director of Creighton University's Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.